For now, here's the short list of the music I played. Started off with Tethered by Holy Fawn. All Night Long by Lionel Richie. Nijimu by 00100. NTR by June Unit. Blue Dune 1 by Sus. We heard Voices of Spring by Moondog. Yellow is The Color of Her Eyes by Sakamami. E did Time. Billie Holiday did God Bless the Child. Dispossession by Algiers. Science Beat by Ciafori. Dream and Formaldehyde by Snapped Ankles. We heard Jack Parsons by Luke Haynes and Peter Buck. Do You Read Me by Field Music. Dust of a Thousand Bells by Laurie Goldstone. And in the background now, Don't Say It Like That by The Chat. And you've been listening to What's the Frequency, Kenneth? I'm Paul Fisher.
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.5 on your radio dial. Stay here.
Well, I guess the promos didn't run quite long enough. I'm sitting here with my phone in my hand. No, that's not a metaphor. And trying to get the Facebook Live set up and stuff like that until the clock says 1 a.m. now. This is WBAI, New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, Teal James Glenn. Oh, come on, you know who he is. Just stay tuned, will ya? Known for only about 5 minutes that Neil Innes, composer and primary performer of that song from the Bonzo Dog Band, died about 2 weeks ago, I am told. And this morning's guest, Teal James Glenn, I've been upset over Terry Jones, who he, along with Michael Palin, I mean, you can't say this is my favorite Python, that is my favorite Python. Python is Python, okay? And even the ones who, as people you don't care for, are inseparable
They were a group organism.
Very much so. Very much so. And I saw that I've known for a long time that Terry Jones had severe issues. In fact, I don't even recall now what he died of. It wasn't Parkinson's.
It was a dementia.
It was some kind of dementia. And it was very sad. His writing partner, his main collaborative partner, was Michael Palin. And I was aware that there was like an effort to get some of the the only Python who died up until now is Graham Chapman. Yeah. And the way that they dealt with that was that they held a memorial for Chapman and all that, and they had an urn with supposedly his ashes on stage and all that. And by the time the bit was over, the ashes were like halfway over the audience. And
yeah, no, they sent him off the way he would have wanted to be sent off.
Oh yeah, it was totally in keeping with who he was. But Terry Jones, while not necessarily in terms of like on camera, the absolute favorite Python, he wasn't as outrageous on camera. Although, you know, he did the cross dressing, he did all the fun stuff.
Yep.
What he did was he was co-director of Monty Python and the Holy Grail. He was the sole director of The Life of Brian. And I'm not sure.
I believe he co-directed Jabberwocky.
I believe Terry Gilliam.
Gilliam solo on that?
Solo on that, which is one of the reasons why it's not quite as good. I love Gilliam, but he's a person who needs somebody checking up on him. And there was nobody doing that. Do me a favor. Tap your microphone. Try that again. Okay. I've got the right mic.
Hello. Hello.
Yeah, pull it closer.
Hello.
Okay, even closer. And angle it up toward your mouth. Yeah.
And how's that?
That's much better.
Hello.
Yeah. Hello, Teal.
I say hello.
Hello. So at any rate, so I saw in the papers today that Terry Jones had died as a result of whatever has been troubling him through the years. I'm aware of the fact that Michael Palin Palin, you know, did all these wonderful travelogue shows, really wonderful travelogue shows, and that he hasn't done any in a few years, partly because, his wife understood, but he wanted to be near Terry Jones, who he knew since the first days in college, and which is where Python was born, was in their, what do they call it, Oxbridge kind of put-together thing, along with Douglas Adams and Terry Pratchett, each one of whom claimed to be the sixth Python.
Yes.
I'm
not sure which one was the drummer, though.
Yeah, right. Douglas actually did work with them.
Yes.
Pratchett was friends with them. And I have a super secret theory about Pratchett and Douglas Adams. It's super secret. I'm not saying.
Oh, well. So you have, if you tell the audience, you have to go and kill every one of them?
No, if I tell the audience, I have to suffer the possibility of lawsuits. It's nothing bad. Our Facebook Live is not connecting well.
Oh, no. It's semi-live.
Well, it's saying right now, try to reconnect, which means that it is somehow.
We are the urban spacemen. We don't exist.
Yeah, no, let me focus here. It means that the Wi-Fi here is inadequate. What a surprise. What I did just now may have fixed it, but anybody who was logged in got logged out. So, folks, log back in, and if this happens repeatedly, we're going to give up on Facebook Live for the morning, and you'll just have to listen to the radio. What a concept.
You'll have to draw pictures.
Yes, exactly. Oh, just like they do on the impeachment trials. That's what I should get one of those people.
Yeah, you can get your own courtroom artist for the radio.
Yeah,
show.
A sketch artist, you know, yep. To sit there and just do that and, you know, post it on
Instagram.
It's a
shame that Mort Drucker's not available because he would be the guy to do me.
Yeah, know? Absolutely. Mort Drucker, yeah, would be exactly right. It would be the right person. Dave Berg, not so much. Mort Drucker.
Mort Drucker. Yeah, I'm a Mort Drucker thing, let's face it.
Yeah, yeah.
If you can't get Sergio Aragonés, which, you know.
No, because all of his characters look alike.
Well, you know, I don't mind looking
like they all wear the same hat. The only question is, what color is the hat?
Well, It drives me mad. Thank you. He'll be all here all week because of the ankle monitor. I actually wrote for Mad. They actually picked up a bit of mine. Back when I was still in college.
Uh-huh.
So I had actually met the original gang of Maniacs and Nick Meglin, just the second gen. And I had a check from Nick Meglin for this thing that actually Paul Coker illustrated.
Okay.
On the modern uses of Velcro.
Wow.
Velcro-covered aircraft carriers, baby clothes, so you could stick the kid to the wall.
I was semi-twins with the daughter of an artist at MAD, Max Brendel, and Eva Brendel lived in the same neighborhood in Queens as I did. She was born within 10 minutes of me.
Ah.
So my mother and her mother shared the same room at the hospital. And so that was my initiation to Mad Magazine. Aside from my crazy uncle, who had every copy of Mad and The Realist, Paul Krasner's The Realist, which I inherited and still have. I had a horrible flood a few years ago. The Mad magazines did not survive, but my issues of The Realist somehow did.
Well, Mad is actually easier to replace.
I'm not looking
to
replace it.
I know, but I'm just saying is that in terms of that and The Realist, you're going to lose one.
You know, I had it, and it's gone, and that's all there is to it. I had a first edition of Lord of the Rings. It's gone. What the horrifying thing is how little financial value. What would you think a first edition 11th impression of Lord of the Rings with all the pullouts, illustrations, and all that on rice paper from George Allen Unwin, the original British publisher of the whole trilogy? What do you think that would be worth today?
Unfortunately, because it's 11th printing, probably not more than like maybe $150, $200.
You're close. It was $400.
Yeah.
You're close.
It's simply because there are so many editions.
It is like saying 11th. When 11th impression means it's using the original plate. So they call it first edition 11th impression. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., they would say that's the 11th edition.
Yeah.
But that's not how they do that in England. In England, it's how often did they have to replace the letter blocks that printed the pages. As long as they use the original letter blocks, it's first edition. But then how many times did they go to press?
Yeah.
That's the impression. So in the U.S., you're right. That would be an 11th edition. In England, it's a first edition, but nonetheless, about $400. Mm. And the way that the insurance company figured that out was very fair. They went to eBay, and they looked not what people were asking for stuff, but what people paid for it.
Which is always, when you're buying stuff, is the real teller. Because you can ask $1 million for an old Coca-Cola can. Mm-hmm. But if someone's not going to buy it, it ain't worth $1 million.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So the the insurance company was very good to me. The thing that was more upsetting was that I have one box. It's a Mr. Coffee box, an old Mr. Coffee box filled with Marvel comics, mostly from the 60s, mostly Doctor Strange, largely Steve Ditko.
So it's that first run.
Yes. So yeah. I took one out at random, and I did the eBay test. $650. One freaking comic book.
It's Ditko. It's Doc Strange, whom, by the way, I played for Marvel for 7 years. I was the official Doctor Strange, and I did the...
When you say played...
I toured the country doing personal appearances. I did a show for the FBI as
Doctor Strange. You've got the right look for it.
I looked... Actually, I looked more like a Bruner than a Doc, than a Ditko Doc. Doctor Strange,
right?
But and I did the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade for 3 years.
Yeah. Wow!
I was Doctor Strange. Well, so I've been Strange professionally.
Okay. Well, we at WBAI have always been Strange. We did the radio series.
Ah. Now, the Rings of Rangipur.
By the Mountains of Madness, and absolutely with John Basis playing Doctor Strange. And I think John Lithgow, may have been in a couple of episodes of those because he had that.
Oh, he would be so good for any of them.
Who's the main?
There's Mordo is
not Morgo. No. Not Baron Mordo. No, the
Dormammu. He would
Dormammu.
Be phenomenal.
Dormammu.
He would be phenomenal.
He was phenomenal.
I could see that.
And
yes.
Timothy Jerome, which, you know, real Broadway fans would know that he was nominated for Grand Hotel however many years ago. But he's a wonderful actor, if not a world-famous actor. And it was really a great series that was produced here. I wonder if ever they considered getting the rights for it. Anyway.
Well, it certainly would be one of those things that in some package somewhere in the future will be worth it. You know?
Nobody knew from Marvel Comics.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
In that era. We are talking mid-60s.
Yeah.
When I was, before I worked at BAI, and I started here in 67. So we're talking before that.
Yeah.
Because that's what I was listening to, that my uncle glued me to the radio and glued me to WBAI. And so Doctor Strange was on PYP, Programs for Young People, which started from 3:30 to 5 every afternoon. Because you got out of school at 3,
right? Absolutely.
So from 3:30 to 5, they had all these 15-minute shows. What a great idea, right?
That's the old radio days. That's the way it was. Jack Armstrong was 15-minute episodes.
Yeah, but
Superman, all of that in the heyday.
But not in the 60s.
No, by that, not in the 60s. It had faded away by the late 50s.
No, but exactly. Nobody else was doing it except for Baird Searles here at WBAI. Baird kept that flame alive and got Peter Zanger and David Rapkin and Timothy Jerome. And when Baird left WBAI, he was replaced by a guy named John Lithgow, who fell into obscurity.
I hope he had some kind of...
He looks like Roger Ailes today's role. And Winston Churchill. Both.
Sad.
Yeah.
Sad.
Well, actually, that is sad. Both sides.
He's kind of like an alien.
Rock Alien. I never cared for that show.
It was I could take it or leave it. I always enjoyed it when I saw it, but it never hooked me to watch it on a regular basis.
By that time, I fell off the sitcom wagon as a kid.
Yeah, no,
I watched every sitcom on TV.
Everybody did because you had very few choices for many nights.
Yeah.
You know? But, no, I think it was one of those shows where I have, anytime I've seen it, I enjoyed it, but I never, like, made a point to see it.
Yeah.
You know? So, but the work was good, and they were all just
The performers, there was no question about it. I just didn't. And to this very day, the only sitcom that I have watched is having its very last final ever episode this week, and that's The Good Place, which is exceptional. And the less said about that, the better. Because have you seen it?
No. Okay. Again, not a sitcomer at all.
Yeah, this is different.
Oh, I know it. The premise of it is really interesting.
Yeah, but the premise is reborn every season.
Mm.
That's the twist. There are reveals that any season, if you are told what happens in the final episode of each season, it's like, what? And you begin to appreciate. And then when they take the premise and say, okay, now this is on a different footing than it was before. And what the show is primarily about is a study of college-level psychology.
Mm.
Immanuel Kant. I mean, this...
You're almost getting me started on that song.
Yeah. And Rene Descartes was a drunken fart. I drink, therefore I am. So getting back, rolling back to the point is that in the last 24 hours or so, Terry Jones of Monty Python died. I only just learned that Neil Innes, who was as close to being the musical end of Monty Python. If you've seen Holy Grail, he's the guy who's singing, you know, Bravely Bold Sir Robin, you know, holding the coconuts and all of that good stuff. And you just heard I'm the Urban Spaceman.
And, of course, the brilliant Ruttles.
And he was a major force in the Ruttles. He wasn't the Ruttles alone. Idle.
Yes.
Had as much to do with that. And, of course, initially, before they split up as a loving couple writing Spamalot, which I saw in previews and was probably better in previews than as it ran later because, you know, the funny thing is, as long as they replicated the film, it was... What's the point? I can quote this film. Mm-hmm. I can act this film as well as any of those people can, although it was lovely seeing Tim Curry on the stage, but with David Hyde Pierce and them folks. But aside from that, what made the show brilliant was they were doing sort of a forbidden Broadway on Broadway, where they do the equivalent of a Jerome Robbins bottle dance from Fiddler on the Roof, where everybody's wearing the hat and they've got the bottle of wine. Well, in Spamalot, they're each got on their head Holy Grails. And they did it. They did the choreography. They did the Jerome Robbins. It was freaking fabulous. And Idle, at that point, he had started doing it with Neil Innes. And somewhere, after like 35 years of collaboration, they had a falling out.
That's always sad.
It really is. And one could hope that they would have gotten back together, but you told me that Neil Innes died a couple of weeks ago, which is why I played I'm the Urban Spaceman. Which is, I guess, my favorite of the Bonzo Dog Band, or if you prefer, the Bonzo Dog Duda Band. Yeah. And if you've never seen the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour, have you ever seen that?
Yes.
The band at the end of the thing, you know, why you have this thing that's perfectly kid-friendly, and it's fun, and it's weird, and it's the Beatles and all that. And then, for some unknown reason, John and George go to what turns out to be a strip club where the Bonzo Dog Band is performing a song called Death Cab for Cutie. Something so popular that there was later on a rock band that called themselves Death Cab for Cutie. But that was Neil Innes.
Yeah.
While this woman gets naked on this kid's TV show. And she really does.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of sitting there scratching my head saying, why?
On the other hand, Britain, certainly Europe, but Britain doesn't quite have the same kind of complete freak-out factor that we have.
Oh, over toplessness and stuff like that. There was another example that one of my favorite movies, Topsy Turvy, about arguably the best backstage musical movie ever made, and it's about Gilbert and Sullivan, which is
its own drama.
GNS is an important part of my life. Mm-hmm. Barbara's my first date was we went to see HMS Pinafore.
At the Elgin?
No, it was on Broadway.
Oh, okay. Because they used to every year the...
Not live.
No, every year the Gilbert and Sullivan players would come to the Elgin.
No. No, they were at another theater at that time.
Oh, way back, I guess, yeah.
Well, yes, I'm talking way back, NIGASP.
Yeah.
I was more of a fan of the American Savoyards.
Mm-hmm.
There were three Gilbert and Sullivan companies in New York. NIGASP is the one that has survived. The Blue Hill Troupe is still occasionally about, but their tickets are steep. They're like $125 or something, but it's for charity. So I can accept that. NIGASP, my problem with them is that all they try to do is to replicate the doily cart productions of the 1950s. Now, the doily cart company, and watch the movie Topsy Turvy for the history of Richard Doily Cart and Friends. The doily cart company was essential. It was important. It was definitive. But by the time Bridget Doily Cart had taken over the company in the 50s, it was not the same. It was a wax museum.
Things calcify after a time.
That's a very good way of putting it. And NIGASP, New York Gilbert and Sullivan productions, their goal has been to replicate the replications of Bridget Doily Cart. So it's like a third carbon copy.
Yeah.
And I helped volunteer for, you know, like Ticket Taker and stuff when they were still at Symphony Space. And I spoke to the director of the company and said, but this is what Gilbert and Sullivan is. And I'm saying, no, it's not. No, it's not.
This is what these productions of Gilbert and Sullivan.
This is the granddaughter of the person who worked with Gilbert, who directed the productions himself, right through about 1920, did. And these were considered inferior. And indeed they was. So I'd still go see them because at least it's GNS and it's fun. But if you watch the movie Topsy Turvy, you get a really good sense of that. So Topsy Turvy is, despite being a film by Mike Lee, brilliant director, is a perfectly, I don't want to say family friendly because it'll make it sound Disney. It's not. But it's PG at worst, except that they had to have a scene where Sullivan goes to France because, of course, he's going to see the operettas of Offenbach, just as Offenbach would go to England to see Gilbert and Sullivan, because these are the only people doing good operetta. It's weird to say serious operetta, but good operetta at the time. And for no reason at all, if I ever get a chance to interview Mike Lee, one of my first questions will be, not why did you set that scene while we're listening to Ophelia's doll dance song in a bordello? Why does she have to be topless? It's just like all of a sudden you're watching this perfectly friendly movie and all of a sudden, boing.
Well, again, it has to do with the fact that it's not unfriendly to countries that are not terrified of breasts, like America seems to be.
Well, America is, you know, the people who left England were called the Puritans.
Yes.
And they came here, and we still have a lot of comparatively puritanical views of the world. But the fact of the matter is, the world is the way that it is. And in England today, if you put, you don't just show that in outside what here in the U.S. we call safe harbor, and there they call watershed time of programming. They don't do that anymore in England. They don't. So why did Mike Lee put that in there? That movie ended up, I think it was a PG, but it's a hard PG.
Mm-hmm.
It, without that, without those 30 seconds, it's a G.
Except we don't know. It, have you seen the British cut of it? It might have been harder.
I have seen all cuts that exist.
Yeah, yeah. Because they're
I have the DVD with three different versions.
There you have it.
Barbara and I bonded over Gilbert and Sullivan, and it's a particularly fine movie, and I love Mike Lee's work in general. His so many TV shows he did, and it turns out at least one movie every 2 years, and they're usually not family fair, but this one was.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as if he said, no, 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 I don't want people to think that I'm getting soft. So let's just throw a curve.
Or, so to speak.
As it were. Yeah, I wasn't going there.
Yes, you went there. You know you were going there.
No, no, after I had gone there, I said, oops, and yep. I ignored it.
But not me.
Okay. Okay. Now, you see, I wanted to have you read something right near the top of the show, and it's already 35 minutes in. So what we have not done is properly introduce you. And I need to do stuff. I just realized I haven't logged into Facebook on this computer. And when I do that, we're going to lose the Facebook live feed momentarily, because the moment you do that, it wants second verification on who you are and does that to my phone. And it's the phone that we are using to project your image.
Oh, no.
On Facebook Live. Now, right now, you know what? Maybe I won't do it. What I can, it just means that right now, if you're listening and if you want to see Teal James Glenn live, you can do that by going to my timeline on Facebook, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D. When I get home, I will share it to Hour of the Wolf, to WBAI Radio, to Teal's homepage, that's T-E-E-L. And it, whereas if I was to go and share it now, which I should have done, it would stop the webcast. So better to share the webcast later for everybody.
So there.
So, who am you? This is your second time on the show, right?
Yes, this is true.
I was. But here. Your first time solo.
First time solo. I am Teal James Glenn, author of a number of books, including this.
On the radio, Terrors. They're not seeing that.
I really.
The three
I just,
people
that's
on Facebook.
I just said the title, Tabloid Terrors, The Further Adventures of Maxie and Moxie, which is The X-Files meets the Thin Man, 1930s husband and wife, who investigate weird things at Universal Studios in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
I have a background as a stuntman for 40 years.
I think the first time that I was where, what was it you? I was at a reading at the Way Station.
I have only been there once for my friend's premiere of their book, Tales from the Way Station.
Then this was not that time, because there was a reading at the Way Station and there were two stunt people that did a demo, a very, very good demo of how stunt work is done. It's like, watch me throw this punch, and they don't come within 3 feet of the people, but because of the angle.
It's all about angles. It's like sleight of hand magic.
Because of the angle, they showed it beautifully. The problem was, is that the readers that night, this is not long after Andy Heidel opened the Way Station. I knew the owner of the Way Station because he was the publicity director for Bantam Books.
Uh-huh.
He went from there to opening this fun bar in Brooklyn with a TARDIS for a toilet and appropriately named drinks.
Yes.
And the readers that night were Michael Swanwick and N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin.
Mm.
Which, you know, and if you don't know about Nora Jemisin, go and buy this week's issue of The New Yorker and read the, I don't know, 10,000-word profile about her. That should tell you a little something, he said snobbishly. and if Nora, also, by the way, this week's Lightspeed Magazine podcast, hosted by me and audio edited by me, is an N.K. Jemisin story, which is sort of a slight relationship to a Le Guin story. But at any rate, so this was like not the most appropriate venue for the person who's basically today wearing the mantle of Octavia Butler,
mm-hmm.
and Michael Swanwick, who today is sort of wearing the mantle of Michael Swanwick.
It would be more appropriate for a lot of what I do. I actually wrote a murder mystery set at a Renaissance fair where the main character is a fight choreographer, which I have done 60 Ren fairs, and that actually was based on the murder of a friend of mine. And I solved it in Murder Most Fair, the book, but of course it was never solved.
Are you saying that was a real-life murder?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the one who found the body and had to deal with his wife. And actually, the real-life wife, who was a wonderful fantasy science fiction writer herself, wrote the afterword of the book because it was very much a Romana Clef about the science fiction community in New York and the Renaissance Fair community in New York.
Well, would I know her name?
Yes. Her name is Gillian Fitzgerald.
Okay. Never met her, I don't believe.
Yeah, she was.
But I know the name.
Yeah, she was. It was the company of the Silver Swan. It was a lot of people from that time period
mm-hmm.
are ghosted or mirrored in some way. But I combined like 3 or 4 different periods of my life into it and built the structure around his death and in the book, the ultimate solving of the murder and retribution. But
so aside from all of this performance on film or live that you do. What else do you do?
Well, I teach stage combat. I actually studied under Errol Flynn's last stunt double.
Whoa.
Paddy Crean. Not for long, but I did study with him, and so there's a little bit of that passed on. I teach short stories and art. I was a book illustrator for many years. And I did all the New York soap operas. I did Spencer for Hire, where I called Hawk a clown, and he beat me up because that's what happens when you call Hawk a clown.
Yes, and then he goes off to Deep Space Nine.
Yes, so. Exactly.
Yeah.
And actually, he got better once he shaved his head and was Hawk in space.
That's true.
But,
it's true.
It really was. He was Hawk in space. Finally, they unleashed
him. I liked
him.
Hawk. There was a rumor for years that they were going to do a Hawk TV series.
They did. They did one season set in... it was called...
Oh, that's right.
A Man Called Hawk. It was set in D.C.
And it was not any good.
It was unfortunate that he was a character that when you started to find too much about him, it didn't work. He worked better as a character kind of in the shadows with a bit of mystery.
Except for the fact that I think they could have made it work.
Oh, I did too.
If they had the right writers who didn't view him as the sidekick to some white guy.
Yes. Well, he was such incredibly powerful. Is such an incredibly
Avery
powerful
Brooks
actor.
Is an amazing.
And aside from having an incredible voice as a singer. But he...
And as a audiobook narrator.
Yes. Well, yeah. Well, when he walked on the set, and he was just this force of nature. And then I'm like, wow, he looks really cool. And then he went into the trailer and came out dressed in his Hawk clothes. It was like, oh, my God, he really is. He was just wonderful. It was, very brief scene, but it was kind of a nice moment in my career early on.
And yeah. And another person we lost in the last few months talking about Avery Brooks and DS9 is we just lost
Rene
Auberjonois, who was a WBAI alumnus. I performed with him as part of Poisoned Arts with Janet Coleman and David Dozer, who are still doing shows on BAI and live stuff, and you should go see them. But Rene, well, I have a couple of Rene stories, but that's off topic for for this morning's show. But he was a hoot and a holler. He was great.
I have friends who work security at a number of the Star Trek conventions and talked about what a delight he was as a guest.
So you see, now I have to tell you the story.
There you go.
Because when I first met him and he was recording a few episodes of what we called the Poisoned Arts Minutes, which were 3 to 5 minute long episodes on the air 4 days a week. Rene was there for one series of all four episodes would be an arc. And Rene was the corner of one of those. And DS9, Deep Space Nine, had premiered on TV about a month earlier. And Barbara, who had worked for Future Life magazine, which was...
I remember that.
She was the editor. That was her magazine. Along with Robin Snelson. And Robin Snelson's magazine. But Barbara was very much involved in there. And they were part of Starlog. And Starlog was and is basically a Trekkie kind of a thing. And if that and if saying Trekkie sounds like a put down, it is. I'm not a Trekkie, I'm not a Trekker, but give me a Trekkie and a Trekker and put us all into a room on a trivia contest and I will win. But anyway, all that aside, so I'm a fan, okay? And here's this wonderful actor, Rene Auberjonois, who I knew from McCabe and Mrs. Miller and some other Robert Altman films. You know, I'm looking at the actor. I'm looking at the career arc. And he's a wonderful character actor. I didn't watch Benson, which he had been on for like 6 seasons. And I had a script that I wrote an adaptation of a short story by Robert Sheckley that Sheckley gave me permission to write. Mm. And I wanted Renee to be the focus voice. And so when he was at BAI and we're recording this thing, and yes, I have pictures. I may post them next to this, the archive of this show. Renee, I say, when can I get this to you? He says, oh, I'm doing this Star Trek convention. Would you believe they have Star Trek conventions? I'm going, yeah, I think I was on the committee of the very first one in New York with Stu Hellinger and the Langsomes and this person and that person. So, yeah, worked with some guy named Roddenberry on it. Yeah. I think I know about him. And he was saying, well, anyway, I'm going to be doing, of all things, a Star Trek convention at what was the Statler Hilton before they reverted to its proper original name, which was the Pennsylvania Hotel.
Yeah.
Okay, you may know the answer to this question. What was the phone number of the hotel?
Oh, I don't remember that at all.
Oh, you should. Pennsylvania 6, 5,000.
Should have known. Yep.
That was it. The Dorseys. Not the Dorseys, Tommy Dorsey. And the arranger was Cy Oliver. And let's not go down that road. I knew Cy Oliver. That's all that aside. Okay, so I say, how do I get the script to you? And he says, oh, well, I'm doing the Star Trek convention in about a month. BAI at the time was at 505 8th Avenue, 35th and 8th, so the Pennsylvania Hotel.
Just over on 7th. Hilton.
Yeah, you know, a block and a half away, long block away. He said, meet me in the lobby. Yeah, Renee, it's not really going to work very well. You show up in that lobby, you are going to be swamped. He said, what are you talking about?
Actors then really did not know the power of it at all.
They had no idea. And I said, these are Trekkies, Renee. And he said, what does that mean? What's a Trekkie? I'm saying, look, you're going to be besieged. People are really going to dote on you, and you deserve it. He said, I was on Benson for 6 years, and I couldn't get a traffic ticket. I said, no.
If Benson had transporters, maybe you would have.
Maybe you would have. I said, no, Renee, this is different, okay? Just leave my name at the door, okay? Tell the people that I'm going to be there and that I'm legitimate and that I should see you. And he said, whatever, but I'm sure that I can be the person at the door.
Uh-huh.
I'm going, yeah, right. So I go to the hotel at the appointed time and I take a look for the nearest Klingon because Klingons are always security.
Yep, that's my friend who worked with them, yes.
At these things. And I say, yes, hi, I'm here to see Rene Aubergenois. And the Klingon says, yeah, so's everybody else in this bleeping place. And I'm saying, no, he's expecting me. Oh, yeah, what's your name? I said, I'm Jim Friend. He says, he's here! So I'm flanked now by four Klingons who frog march me into like a pantry of the kitchen area, and there's Renee with his eyes closed, his head on his elbows, and just like I'm saying, so how was your day, Renee? I thought you were going to meet me at the front entrance. He said, you warned me. And I said, what happened? And he said, I got up on stage, I did my presentation, which went very well. And when the questions came, somebody said, when you turn from being Odo into a suitcase, what happens to all that mass?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I don't know. Ask my agent.
See, I remember him from Pinache.
Ooh.
That's...
Yes.
Because I'm a sword guy.
Right.
You know, and I'm actually one of the... I'm still looking for a copy of that because I haven't seen it since it originally ran.
Okay, you know, I've never seen it. I know of it.
Yeah. It was... It came out... We were talking before about the Lester Three and Four Musketeers. It came out to cash in on that as a TV movie, and it was a pilot for a TV series. They were saying, can we do something kind of like the Three Musketeers? How about Pinache? Okay. And they did it as a TV movie.
Wow. Yeah.
But
check YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing the stuff that ends up on
YouTube. Yeah, no, every once in a while I do check again to see if it's there. You know, things show up and go away and come back.
Spelled in the same way that Rostand?
Yes, yeah.
Spelled it P-A-N-A-C-H.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, Rostand invented that word for Cyrano de Bergerac.
Yes, yes.
I believe that was invented for that play.
Yeah.
So at any rate, so that was my that's my René not the actor not really knowing.
Yeah. Well,
oh, and
it was
and I saw him again about 2 months later. He comes back to WBAI to visit Janet Coleman, and I'm saying so. How's your Star Trek stuff going? And he says, oh, God, it is so wonderful. I'm doing a cruise next month. I'm doing this. I've done 4 conventions. I refuse to charge what they tell me to charge for an autograph. It's like, that's just stupid, ridiculous. They're paying me very good money to be at this convention. Why should I be charging for autographs? He said, you know, I'm mainly coming to New York to visit my son. Remy, I think. Remy Auberginois. And he had quite a large family. Most of them were in New York. So he was living in New York for a while. But, you know, he just acclimated so quickly. But Barbara and I also knew more about DS9, a lot more than he did, because he was simply, well, shall we say, on the staff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was... You know,
on the team, but he was telling Barbara and I stories about the other acts. Well, particularly one
out of school,
on and not repeatable on the radio because you don't repeat what other people have said. It's third hand by the time it gets onto the air.
And besides, you can't do that with a marmoset unless it's willing.
Indeed. Indeed. A capuchin monkey, maybe.
Well,
but a marmoset, they're too small.
Yeah.
Capuchin monkeys are half an inch larger. So we were getting dirt. The kind of stuff that today would... I mean, Robert Downey, about a week and a half ago, did an off-the-cuff interview to promote Doolittle. And why, by the way, can't anybody make a good Dr. Doolittle movie? I know the source material is problematic because it was written 110 years ago. But, you know, the same problem exists with Mary Poppins.
See, I think that the thing was Doolittle is the kind of character that lends itself to episodic. It should be half-hour shows. It doesn't need to be a feature.
You know, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Because they're little vignettes, and they keep trying to stick them together into making a big story.
Although they were all novels. There were never any short stories.
But they always felt like vignettes.
You could go chapter by chapter as a kid. And, you know, just how Gub-Gub throws a dart and misses the they're going to go on vacation. And he throws it, and it goes off the chart. And they say, oh, so we're going to the moon.
Yep. So I mean, I think that's one of those things that is really born for episodic.
Yeah, I never thought of it, but I think you're absolutely right. At any rate, Robert Downey is promoting this terrible film, and he said it was Susan Downey, who's really the brains of the outfit. He's the talent,
mm-hmm.
and she's the management. And I wonder how his father is doing. He's still alive. He must be. Robert Downey, a prince. The movie director.
Yeah, yeah.
Putney Swope, Greaser's Palace.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just don't know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, thinking of so many drugs in him, he can't die. He's like Keith Richards, you know. But at any rate, well, I mean, that was his legacy. At any rate, the interviewer asked Downey, you know, so, do you think you'll ever come back as Iron Man? And Downey said, hey, you never know. These are comic book things. Anybody can come back. And he's just saying that in passing, right? He doesn't want to say yes.
Yeah.
He also doesn't want to say no. He wants to see what the contract is and what the script is before he says anything. He's not going to close anything off. But this is, you know, a half-hour interview. He says that in passing. Boom! Clickbait headlines everywhere. Downey says Iron Man can return.
Well, they've talked about him actually coming back as an AI in Ironheart, the series. Which would make sense.
Ah, okay.
You know, sort of an Obi-Wan Kenobi three-dimensional advising the young girl.
Yeah, except for the problem that Downey is aging.
Well, but...
And they have de-aging stuff, but how long does he...
If he's coming back as an AI, it doesn't even actually have to be his visual.
That's
true. It can be an animated visual of him in a computer form, so...
It's time for the man to move on. He's a wonderful actor. And he has so much to offer.
Well, there's talk, and I think he'd actually be perfect. There's talk of doing a Perry Mason series.
More than talk.
And set period. And he would be an excellent Perry Mason from the original pulps.
Yes.
Yeah. Perry Mason was
going back to the what was the name? Warren Williams. Was it Warren Williams?
Warren Williams did it. Ricardo Cortez did it.
Oh, my God, did he?
They all did all the characters, you know. They all were like passing through.
But yeah, but Downey is in that mold.
Yeah, and
he is in that mold,
and
of course.
And that Perry Mason was a little bit more of an action hero.
And by the way, for anybody who doesn't know, I recommend a Ricardo Cortez film, co-starring B.B. Daniels, called The Maltese Falcon.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what... You know, that's an odd title. I wonder.
Did they remake it?
They might have. I don't know.
Okay, so there's a trivia question for you. It was remade as The Maltese... Right. You're giving me the fingers, as it were.
Maltese Falcon, then Satan Was a Lady.
Bingo.
With Bette Davis.
Absolutely.
As Satan herself.
And it's a comedy.
Yes.
It's a comedy.
Yes. That's all right. What was the...
In a way, the John Huston film is a comedy as well.
Well, yeah,
it's
got dark comedy because he used direct lines from the book. They basically just took the book and scripted it. But here's one for you. What was the first version of Farewell, My Lovely?
Murder, My Sweet.
No.
Oh.
Murder, My Sweet was the title of it, but it was made before that as an episode of the Falcon series with Moose Malloy.
Okay.
Yes, and then later on it was renamed.
Who played Moose Malloy in that?
Mike Mazurki.
No, Mike Mazurki was in Murder, My Sweet.
Yeah, Mike Mazurki.
So he did it twice?
Yeah.
Okay, he's right. And then it was Richard Kiel.
Yeah.
A.K.A. Jaws from the Roger Moore Bond films.
Yeah.
Was a great... And I've got to say that Robert Mitchum...
Oh, he was born to be the smoky-eyed detective. Come on, yes.
Oh, my God. He was...
Unfortunately...
I don't know the bit... Yeah, we're going to both say the same thing.
Yeah, the second one...
The Big Sleep just... It was interesting because, remember, people, in case you didn't know, Raymond Chandler was not some guy from L.A. writing about his hometown. He was a British aristocrat who looked down on L.A., but he wanted to write the great American novel, which is why he was doing all these wonderful Philip Marlowe things. And he... So the idea of taking who Raymond Chandler was and transposing Philip Marlowe into the world of Raymond, the real world of Raymond Chandler. It didn't work, but I admire the conceit.
Yeah.
Of trying to do that. It was really a deconstruction.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, when they did Murder, My Sweet, Farewell, My Lovely, the film,
Murder, My Sweet, we should tell people who don't know, starred Dick Powell. It was his breakout from being a juvenile singing lad in Busby Berkeley movies into doing serious noir.
And after that, he did nothing but noir, basically.
Yeah, which is too bad. He should have found
And producing. He created four. He was one of the producers for Four Star Television.
He was moved into TV the early on. Producer.
Yeah, he's
as
sad.
Far as I
and,
know.
Well, no, him and originally it was Four Stars. It was him and David Niven.
No, they were Four Stars, but he was the producer.
True. True. He was the organizer of them. Yeah. Yes.
Yes. But and David Niven.
David
there was
Niven,
a woman.
I think it was.
If you say the name, I'll know it, but I can't come up with it on my own.
I'm seeing her. It wasn't Betty Davis.
No. It was a British woman.
But exactly. But it was at that level. It was at that level.
And Robert Coote.
Yes.
Was in there.
COOTE. As I started to say about.
Sorry.
That's right. The way they shot the film was they pre-exposed it, so it gave it that smoky quality.
Right.
That gave you, even though it was in color, it felt like a black and white film.
Yeah.
And then they interposed the whole storyline about the baseball game and going for that to give you a full – and it was a brilliant adaptation.
Yeah.
Noir pulp, that's my thing.
So who is, therefore – there's only one answer. Who is the best writer of Philip Marlowe movies?
Lee Brackett.
Of course, because to begin with, only one person wrote two.
Yep.
And while they put William Faulkner's name
like a name of a character.
Well,
you know.
He had something to do with it, but the way that it's often told, and also this Jules Firthman, who then after that worked with Lee Brackett on any number of projects. But the way that one person expressed it was basically Faulkner was in the writer's room having had his fourth or fifth martini with his head in the soup bowl, and Jules Firthman and Lee Brackett wrote The Big Sleep, and they'd lift Faulkner's head and say, "Hey, we're doing this, Bill, how's that?" "You know, fine." And they'd drop his head again.
Yeah, pretty much.
And that was it. But compare The Big Sleep with all of its wonderful set pieces to The Long Goodbye with, Bogart versus Elliot Gould. And you know what? It works.
I don't like The Long Goodbye.
A lot of people don't. Some people incorrectly call it the best Marlowe film ever.
Is it essentially a deconstruction of a deconstruction?
Yes.
And on that basis...
But it's Altman.
And Altman doesn't do it for me the way it does for many other people.
This is where we differ. Okay.
Except, I will say, I think Nashville is brilliant.
Many people put it in their top 10 American films.
Most other Altmans don't do it for me. And part of it is the
you
way...
You didn't love Countdown?
I can't use those words.
One of the worst science fiction films ever made.
Which is saying an awful lot, considering how many bad ones there are.
Yeah, and he also did a post-apocalyptic one called Five.
Yes, which was shot at the Montreal World's Fair by just spraying.
At Expo 67, really?
By spray all of those buildings, what they just did is they sprayed. It's Quintet, actually, is the title.
That's it. Thank you.
They sprayed all the buildings with water, let it freeze, and that was their set.
Cool.
Exactly.
No pun intended.
Interesting for the conceit, not for the execution, but that he was so free.
But that's what Altman did. He did a
it
lot.
It was about the conceit.
It was about the experimentation.
Yes.
He loved theater. He was almost a theater guy first and a movie guy second, or yes, at least after his initial films.
Yeah.
And then he went into theater heavy and hard for a period where he didn't make a lot of films. And then he starts being real experimental with films like Health with Carol Burnett and Dick Cavett and all that. And to him, it's like, well, you can do a show off Broadway. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter. People will still see it. They'll appreciate it. And they'll watch the evolution of theater. He thought he could do that with movies, which in a business sense doesn't work.
No, because the amount of money necessary on every level of it is exponentially greater.
Although to mount an even off-Broadway show.
Wow. Yes.
Always.
Yeah.
I've worked.
Yeah.
On, and I'll talk about it off-air only, but I've done three off-Broadway shows, one of which moved. And for those people who are in the theater, when you say something moved, that means it was upgraded.
Yeah.
And I won't even say more than that, because then people can actually look it up to find out what I'm talking about, and I'm not going to do that. But because of associations with people and stuff like that, people who are still working today who are huge industry names. So all that aside, I'm a big Philip Marlowe fan, as was Simon Locley, whose show used to follow mine.
Yeah.
And I really like The Long Goodbye. It is a deconstruction of, I wouldn't say a deconstruction of deconstruction. I would say it's a deconstruction of a parody.
Yes, that's actually even a better term, because it's almost a pastiche of itself.
Right, and I'm using parody in its technically correct sense, because parody is a musical phrase, meaning that if Mozart took in some phrases that Haydn had, that's a parody.
Yeah.
That's exactly the definition of a parody, or the original meaning, anyway. So, in that sense, Farewell, My Lovely was that. But also, I love Farewell, My Lovely. I think it really captures the essence of Marlowe, even though it's so wrong. And yet he gets it right.
Yes, yeah.
But the remake of The Big Sleep.
Well, I mean, and
but you know what? I'll take that over Lady in the Lake.
Yeah. Yeah. Lady in the Lake was an experiment that did not work.
Robert Montgomery,
And a brilliant idea for something, which, you know, it waited until 2015 to do, was it Something Henry, Crazy Henry, where the Russians did this film entirely a POV, but it's a stunt movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting concept, but not for the film. And the producers were smart enough to go, wait a minute, you got to give us a prologue and an epilogue, because you got to know what the guy looks like.
You know? Right.
It's just a little, it's too much of a concept. It's too much of a conceptual thing. The script is actually not bad. If you can divorce it from the film itself and actually just listen to the dialogue, it's actually not a bad adaptation script-wise.
Hmm.
It's just, you become so involved in the trickery of the camera work that you forget the story.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, the whole idea of a camera is
which, in the case of some Russian films, is a necessity.
Yeah, but no, what I'm talking about actually Lady in the Lake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lady in the Lake. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I've been saying the script is actually not a terrible adaptation if you can divorce it from the way it's shot.
It's not just how it's shot. I mean, Audrey Totter, who's a fine actress.
The cast is wrong for all of it.
The cast is wrong. Robert Montgomery
You know what? His
daughter is fine.
Robert Montgomery, 5 or 10 years later...
Twitching her nose.
No. 5 or 10 years later, Montgomery might not have been a bad Marlowe when he was a little more world-weary and a little less the...
And a bit more of a political fascist?
I'm talking about the visual of the actor. I divorced from the rest of it.
Okay, you mentioned Errol Flynn earlier.
Yes, a whole other beast. But in terms of the actual... If you could divorce from the cast and the way it's shot, which is saying a lot, but it's still, in terms of the, it's actually not a bad script, is what I'm saying. You could take that script and another director might have been able to shoot it well.
I would like to see somebody try, because it's also been a long time
since we've
had a good Philip Marlowe movie.
Yes.
Usually you have a good one like every 15 years.
Well, you know, the Garner one was not terrible. It was a little too stylish. Yeah.
It's based on the little sister. It's simply called Marlowe.
And it's got Bruce Lee in it. And it's not. They stuck him in there because Sterling Sullivan was a student of his. So we can divorce that.
The Bruce Lee scenes in that film are embarrassing.
Well, they're embarrassing because they're totally experienced to the story. They really don't have anything to do with anything.
They're also
silly.
They're silly and they're exploitative and ethnically.
He did it just to give Bruce some work. Because he was a student of Bruce. And Bruce said, I'll write you to a movie. I'll give you some work. And you go, okay. You know. But the fact is that in terms of Garner's not a bad choice for Marlowe.
Garner was great.
You know. And it's just a little too much of its time in terms of how it's shot and the color and all the rest of it. But it's actually, again, not a bad script.
No, it's not only not a bad script. The parts of it that work, the stylized, the culmination, the finale of that movie, where you simply see the look on the face of not the killer, but the person who's going to take their revenge. You don't need to see what happens, and
yes.
You don't.
Yes.
It's very,
like you say, about once every 15 years, you know.
Yeah, but
we're due for one.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We're due for one. And I wonder who's going to be the one to do it. A lot of good directors, a lot of good auteurs out there now. And maybe not an American.
Well, it's certainly, I think, Marlowe is a character that really needs to be set, period. It's like Mickey Spillane's My Camera needs to be set, period. There's some characters that don't evolve
time-wise. And yet, the Robert Altman film worked.
You say. I don't think it does.
Not only do I say, but...
Yes.
But,
yeah.
And I'm not saying that this is definitive.
No.
But let me say that I am not alone.
But I will give you this. His world-weary attitude worked in California of that period because it's still California. It was still, there was a certain...
It was just also that laissez-faire kind of thing with, you know, everything from the cat and his going in the tone that Robert Altman sets with music by Johnny Williams.
Yes.
Who wrote that song there. So long, goodbye. And what,
yeah.
And you know, the alarm clock goes off. The music is playing. It's an instrumental. He goes and he turns that off. He goes into the kitchen. He turns on another radio. And there's a different version of the same song picking up for the last one left. He goes to the supermarket to buy cat food. And the music in the background is the same song.
Well, you see, to me, that's the same joke as in Our Man Flint, where it's always da-da-da in everything. It's
okay.
Hilarious.
Except that Our Man Flint is a knee-slapping...
Yes, no, I agree.
It's
much subtler
and,
in that.
And
the
long
yes.
goodbye works.
It's got some very dark moments, and yes, it does work. I'm just saying, I love that conceit of...
Including the casting of Nina Van Pallant, Sterling Hayden, and Jim Boughton.
Yeah.
who once beamed me. He once beamed me. He threw a softball hitting me hard. I got a welt from it. It was
Ladies and gentlemen, you have an explanation for James Freund's career.
There you go. No, it's just on the arm. But it was WBAI Radio versus WABC News in the softball game in Central Park. And they had a ringer, you know. You know, it's like one thing that, you know, if they had had some news junkie, you know, some drama critic pitching, that would be one thing. But they had a New York Yankee throwing a softball. And damn, if he could have thrown a knuckleball with a softball, he would have. He played to win. He apologized. And well, he should have, because he's the murderer in... Oops, spoilers.
Dun, dun, dun.
He was the murderer in the Broadway League. It was actually the Broadway League. Why we were two TV... A radio station and a TV station, we were in the Broadway League. I don't know. I have been whittling away our time because I'm having too much fun talking. And yet, it is 2:17. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Words fall out.
Yes, and they take time, and the time flies. I'm thinking what we might do is play a cut of music, and then you'll read for us.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, more Neil Innes?
It has to be. Absolutely.
Okay. Any requests? Not Monster Mash.
No, no, no. Although I did work with him.
So did I.
Yes. I was actually on the morning show as a backup ghoul when he did a version of the Monster Mash when I worked at Madison Square Garden.
He came to WBAI to work with Frank Heller, if you're listening, Frank High, and Peasy, Peter Zanger, who I know never listens, to do Star Trek.
Ah.
And I got to voice the elevator. Every time we went into the elevator, it's like, you know, take me to the bridge. I'm fine. How are you? And it's all that the elevator would.
You were chef.
Say, so, you know, I'd give up the elevator and beam up to the different floors on the thing. But that was Bobby Pickett, Bobby Boris
Pickett.
Pickett. The flip side of that was a song Frank Heller wrote, which was King Kong, Your Song. No offense, Frank, but really? But at any rate, a lot of Frank's brilliant stuff. Frank was sort of like Frank Zappa, but more demented.
Oh, my.
Yeah. At any rate, he stole my scooter when I was 6. All he did was ride it around the block, but I was only 6. I didn't know. He lived in my uncle's building half a block from me.
Your traumas have shaped you, sir.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I wonder if that trauma shaped him. Okay, so let's see. A Bonzo song, right?
I would think so.
Okay. Hunting Tigers. I mean, ethnically, it's a problematic song.
Yes, many of those were.
Yeah, well, you know, maybe sometimes we have to avoid those because times change. Tubas in the Moonlight. Oh, I've got it.
Well, don't give it to me, for God's sakes, man. I don't have any penicillin.
Yes, well, let's just say I'm calling you. So, let's see, let's find which one here. It'll be one of these two. Put them both on. One of them will play. And we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Thank you. can share a hall beneath the ceiling of blue. We'll spend our heavenly day here while the whispering waters play. There's a whippoorwill, he's calling you. By a waterfall, he's dreaming too. And the magic melody Mother Nature sings to me beside a waterfall with you. All together now. By a waterfall, I'm calling you. We can share it all beneath a ceiling of blue. We'll spend a heavenly day here where a whispering waters play. There's a whippoorwill, he's calling you. By waterfall, he's dreaming too. Mother Nature sings to me beside a waterfall with you.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI, vibrating 99.5 million times every second. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Teal James Glenn, who, by a coincidence, I have been given to understand that you have a reading coming up.
Why? Yes, I do. I have a reading coming up on February 4th, along with Elizabeth Crowens.
Tuesday,
February 4th, along with Elizabeth Crowens at 7 o'clock at the Brooklyn Commons.
Although we suggest that people show up about 6:30.
And it's got a lovely menu and is a very nice place to hang out.
And there are new old people or old new people. The people who ran it 3 years ago are back to running it again. And Nora, not Jemison, but a different Nora, is back there working there largely actually to support her boyfriend, who's lead chef. This guy makes soups. Wow.
The food is
don't order the soup because I get the leftovers. So don't order the soup because I want it. I don't like white bean soup, but he gave me some along with the black bean soup I ordered. The black bean soup was proper Cubano, you know, black bean soup. But the white bean soup, it's the first time I've really liked.
They do good work.
They do excellent
work
there.
They're lovely to us. The facilities are excellent. I'll be reading with Elizabeth Crowens. She's going to be reading some selections from A Pocket Full of Lodestones, her newest book in the Time Traveler Professor series. I'll be reading some selections from...
And you'll be involved in that.
I will be reading with her. We're actually going to do it as a dramatic presentation. I'll also be reading from Gaslight Magic, which is a novel of mine that just signed with a British publisher. It'll be out later this year. And we're going to be basically...
Now, are you having any participation from anybody else?
It will be Elizabeth and I reading. We're going to be doing some of it dramatically. Both of us going to be reading together as it's a dramatic presentation.
This is actually a business question because I'm finding out how many mics do we need to set up?
Just the two of us.
Okay.
Just
two,
the two of us.
Two mics.
But I have multiple personalities, so there may be many more inside my head.
Now, there's Lister.
And
what are you doing with your clothes on? Anyway.
And we'll also, we're encouraging people to come and dress in Victorian or steampunk.
One second.
Both stories will be.
Lister, could you do me a huge favor? Two waters. Thank you. He usually does it unbidden. In fact, I can be sitting here with water and he'll bring me water. But
a Gunga Din to the end.
Much better than that. Yeah, this is no Sam Jaffe here. And he's a better man than I am.
They wanted originally to be the Indian, and he was not available.
Sabu?
They wanted Sabu for the role, and he was not available, so they basically said to Sam Jaffe, do Sabu.
Okay, I wonder, there was a point, I understand, where Sabu became, well, a little bit hoity-toity about himself as a performer, was
not
asking.
Really. A friend of mine wrote a biography of him.
Oh, really? Yeah. I'd love to
Philip
read
Philip Leibfried wrote a wonderful biography about Sabu.
Thank you.
And actually,
thank you, Lister.
Very much, sir.
Wave hi to the Facebook people.
Here, I'll pass this off to you, and I'll take this one.
Okay.
And he wrote a wonderful biography of Sabu and is still in contact with Sabu's widow.
Ah.
He was a tail gunner. During World War II.
I knew
he was
that.
Very proud to serve
in the United States
Army Air Corps.
And for those people who don't know, when they say stupid things like, you know, there was the animatronic version recently that Jon Favreau put out of The Jungle Book, and people say, well, in the original Jungle Book, no, the original Jungle Book was directed by Alexander Korda, starring Sabu, and is to date the best filmed version of that story. Go see it now. Turn off your radio. Go out and
Not
find
until after
some.
I read.
Okay, right after,
yeah.
Right after Lister's show at yes. 5 a.m. Go out and get a copy of The Jungle Book, directed. Actually, it's probably not that hard to find online.
No, it's at this point, it's available. And actually, there's some restorations of it that are available, too. Mm.
And it's a fine movie, and it's much, much closer to the Kipling.
Yes.
Than anything else.
And Sabu is just so elementally wonderful as Mowgli.
The only thing is that it's and the Mowgli movie, yeah, it needed a better script, but it was so well made. And and that was very close to the Kipling.
Yes.
Movie called Mowgli, directed by Gollum.
Andy Serkis.
Thank you. Andy Serkis, who I was mentioning Topsy Turvy by Mike Leamy for. First movie I ever saw with Andy Serkis. He plays the choreographer.
Mm-hmm.
He did a number of Mike Lee films. As himself.
Yes. Before he went to Middle Earth.
And having Peter Jackson mispronounce the name of the character. How do you say the name of the character?
Funny looking guy. I'm not even going to try.
I think I can do it. Let me get a sip of water. Gollum. Gollum.
Mm-hmm.
That is how his name is said. Read Tolkien, people, to discover how that name is pronounced. He makes a noise that's a gulping sound while he's in that cave, and he's constantly just going, Gollum. And it is Bilbo and other characters who call him Gollum, making fun of the fact that he makes this noise all the time. His name properly, of course, is Smeagol.
Yeah.
Not Smeagol, Smeagol. But if you call him by his nickname, it's Gollum. As is Gandalf. Rhymes with half. And I won't even repeat the story on the air of how I got these pronunciations, but suffice it to say that I was on the phone with Professor Tolkien, and that's my source. If you've got a better one, let me know. It ain't Peter Jackson. Not that Jackson didn't do a good job for the most part, even though he left out Tom Bombadil and left out the entire finale of the novel. You're looking at me. This you don't know.
No, I know.
You're familiar with Sharky's End.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which is the whole point. Tolkien's whole point of writing the book was about the dangers of industrialization. And that's what happens when Wormwood and Saruman, not Saruman, Saruman, take over Hobbiton.
Well, you tear down paradise and put up a parking lot.
Exactly.
Do, 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 do.
So, the reading will be Tuesday, February 4th.
At the Brooklyn Common.
At 388 Atlantic Avenue. Very easy to get to where we are. We're at the Brooklyn Commons right now. We're just on the third floor, which WBAI has about a third of the floor of. We had the whole floor that's gone because it went to people who pay their rent. And so doors open about 6:30. It is webcast over Facebook Live. But nonetheless, we want you there live. So please do join us. I'll repeat this information next week. But it will be a very, very fun evening.
And as I said, if you want to come in your best Victorian or steampunk attire.
Yes. I think we need to promote that.
Our stories feed into that. We have a couple of Holmesian stories, and my Gaslight Magic excerpt is actually
But you need the glasses. That's the main thing. They even have those glasses. I don't know why they decided that she has to wear them, but on Doctor Who, on most episodes, Jodie Whittaker, as the Doctor, is wearing her steampunk glasses.
Yep.
And I'd love to see them try to do that at the weigh station. They wouldn't be able to serve a drink without spilling it if they wore the proper attire. But that shouldn't stop people from showing up in attire. I'm going to have to call Nora and Steve, the barristers. They were very much wanting. They thought that last month was going to be David Bowie based. Was actually December was going to be that, and we switched to the Beatles instead. But they thought last month was going to be it, and they were so ready to wear all their glitter outfits and their Bowie stuff. But I think I can get them to, you know, do a little steampunk.
I think it would be lovely. I think it would, yeah.
Yeah, they'll have the same food, but they'll rename it. They'll rename it appropriately, although I had such good names for the Beatles evening.
Across the Universe and Beyond.
You know, Across the Universe was the name of the book.
Indeed.
Edited by Randy Don and Michael J. Ventrella.
Editors.
And a whole lot better than the movie by the same name.
Yes, with a lot of really wonderful stories from literally across the universe and multiverse.
Yes, and there's a whole other collection that came out last year of alternate history stories of the Beatles called Alt Together Now by James Ryan, which have you read that?
I have not.
There is a short story in there that takes place today at a Doctor Who convention where the Beatles didn't happen. That's usually where all of these things start. The Beatles never happened, and Richard got himself a job in show business alongside Patrick Troughton playing a companion of the Doctor. So he's at a Doctor Who convention, and he's on stage, and he's talking about this band that he used to be a member of, that that didn't quite make it, and all the people and all the Doctor Who fans are asking him about this failed band called the Beatles. It's clever. It's very, very clever. And it really works with all the characters, and it brings in a lot of the people who really made Doctor Who, and brings in a lot of people who really were involved.
Talk about crossing the streams.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. Very clever story.
Very cool.
So that's in a different...
Beatles.
A different Beatles, yes, world. And then, of course, there's Liverpool Fantasy.
Yes.
By Larry Kerwin.
I used to roadie for Turner and Kerwin.
Did you now?
I was the guy who carried the speakers in and out of all the places up in Fordham.
Did you? So you were, but you didn't go with Black 47?
No, by then I was off doing other stuff, and because Black 47 came after the fact, but I was there when they were Turner and Kerwin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were really good. They were very good.
They were wonderful. I mean, that was the period where I went to Parsons School of Design. Down the block was a bar called the Bells of Hell. And in the back room of Bells of Hell, you could hear people like them or this, I don't know, this band that I don't know what happened to them called the Chieftains, where you'd be sitting 5 feet away.
Well, they weren't there that often because they weren't in New York that often.
I know, but I'm saying that's...
Kerwin's from Brooklyn, yeah.
Those are the kind of guys that would be in this bar, and that's where I met them and ended up roading for them.
Yeah, well, I still want to produce Liverpool Fantasy.
Yes, it's a great play.
It's.
I think it would
you.
Be a wonderful film, but it's a great play.
Film?
I think you could make it as a film. I think you could.
They tried with Yesterday. It didn't
work.
You'd
have to deconstruct it, but the concept is so
brilliant. No, I'll tell you what it is. It's not a film. It's a radio drama.
Yeah, that would work. That would definitely work. For those of you who don't know, it's a wonderful play wherein...
It's one of the best alternate universe science fiction works ever written. Forget who it's about.
I agree. Where in another world, one of the Beatles meditating contacts the Beatles in a world where they didn't exist. And
it takes place in the present, which is actually the late 80s, because that's when the play was done. I saw it twice. And
I'm trying not to give away too much.
I give the whole thing away. Why not? Basically, everybody meets at the home of John and Cynthia Lennon. The whole thing hinges on the fact that the song "Till There Was You," and this is true in real life, "Till There Was You" was the first Beatles single, and the B side was "Please Please Me." But George Martin, no RR involved, George Martin, the producer, said, no, let's put Please Please Me as the A side. "Until There Was You" is the B side. Now, that's what happened in our universe. In the universe of this play, "Till There Was You" from The Music Man is the A side. And it's Paul singing. And there's very little Beatles to it. And as a result of this hit single, Paul gets hired as a lounge singer in Vegas. And so the band never matures. It never happens. So Richard goes off and plays in any pub that will have him. George becomes a priest. And John continues being an abusive husband. Because, sorry folks, that's what he was. There are police records. You can deify him all you want, but he was human. And who's the son? Julian?
Julian.
Julian is a skinhead. And the Vietnam War is not over because the counterculture never really took hold. It's not that the Beatles created the counterculture.
But they were in the
They
forefront.
Made it mainstream.
Yeah.
Along with Walter Cronkite, they made it mainstream. And so these four guys get together umpteen years later to talk about that band they had, and they deconstruct the song Please Please Me, and they do it in a manner that only a master musician could really do. Now, I understand Larry Kerwin turned it into a novel, and I only just got a copy of the novel thanks to Randy Dawn.
Oh, awesome.
I didn't know the novel existed.
I had heard it existed, but didn't have any way to track it down.
I have acquired it, and I can reacquire it to you. But suffice it to say that this is fan service to the Beatles, real bona fide. Let us really appreciate the musicality of what they did. And at the same time, let's take a look at the what they did to modern culture by their very existence. And finally, last and perhaps foremost for some of us, let's write great science fiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the best works of alternate history this side of Harry Turtle Dove.
Yep. I was going to say, it's right up there with Probability Brooch.
Exactly.
Boom. It's right there.
Exactly. And it would have gone on Broadway. It should have gone on Broadway. The second time I saw the show, there were limousines around the off-off Broadway theater. It was a public school, actually, an auditorium. There were limousines all around. There were tuxedos for this off-off Broadway show of famous, famous producers. And they wouldn't go near it. Because God knows how much litigation they would have to go through to say, well, Paul's just a lounge singer. John is a problem personality.
Yeah.
And just
you always run into that when you're dealing with real people and real living people.
But one of them, perhaps the most problematic of all, isn't living.
Yes.
But he has a wife who looks out for his legacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the case that it's why they didn't make any Wyatt Earp movies. Until and any time they told that story up until the late 40s, they couldn't use the names.
Right.
And then they changed the names.
There's one person who did, a sports writer.
Oh, Bat Masterson. But he
Bingo! Oh, my God! Nobody else would have known that.
I actually have a short story I'm writing with Bat Masterson and Annie Oakley.
Ooh.
They foil an assassination of the new president, Teddy Roosevelt, who had made Bat a federal marshal.
Oh, that sounds
which
like
really happened, not the assassination part, but he really made him a federal marshal.
Did he? Okay.
And she lived in New Jersey.
I knew of him mostly as a sports writer.
Yes, but for a short period of time, based on his reputation, Teddy had made him a federal marshal, and people said it was political. So he withdrew it. He said, "Oh, no big deal," and he was a sports writer, and he died at the typewriter.
Right.
He died in
that
the middle
I knew.
Of the column.
That I knew.
Yeah.
And one of his eulogies was written by Damon Runyon.
Yep. Yep.
Who was also a sports writer, of course.
Yes, who was much the inspiration for my Maxie and Moxie stories.
And Damon Runyon owned the bar where Mr. Masterson imbibed.
Yes.
Heavily. I think he was on the tab there.
Yep.
You oh my God.
No, but
we're not gonna get it in, are we?
It's an 8-minute story.
We don't have 8 minutes.
I know. The fact is, people are going to have to come
to
the Brooklyn Commons.
That's it.
February 4th, if they want to hear me read from Gaslight Magic or my Sherlock Holmes pastiche.
I am going to get a nasty call from our program director. She is going to say to me, Jim, you told me that you were going to put your writer's readings right near the top of the show to make the show that much stronger.
Except tonight, because of you can tell her I said it's okay because they were pythons.
Oh, she'll listen to you.
Yeah. So they were pythons, so I'm okay with that, folks.
I'm lucky because I've known our program director for, oh my God, 40 years?
A mere blink of an eye.
Well, she was gone for 20 of them. You know, she had to go and be a news person for the CBC, Canadian Broadcasting. Yeah.
Well, I see. It was 20 years here, but by the way, let me
tell listeners, she brought back a folk music show to WBAI too freaking long. The fact that her husband is a host of the show. Well, oh, wait, he was music director of this radio station before she met him. Okay, fine. But and the other person is Ed Haber, who did the best folk music show ever. No, let me take that back. One of the best folk music shows ever in New York. We have to give Oscar Brand his due. Right, from the WNYC. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Robert Sherman with Woody's Children. But then there was Ed Haber with Piper in the Meadow Straying. And Eddie is back working with Richard Barr doing a folk music program here in WBAI. And all I can say about that is, yay! Our programming is getting better. Let's see if we can survive.
Hope is always eternal.
So mote it be. So, you see, I have to put on the theme music at, it's 2:48, but I have to put on the theme music at 2:56. That's why we don't have time.
There you have it.
Yeah. So, you're already wearing your headphones. So, let us see what we get here. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Morning. When is Hedy Haber's new show on?
I don't know. Ed, not Hedy. Ed.
Okay, sorry.
Edward Haber.
Haber, yes, yes, yes. So his new show, thank goodness it's back.
Yes.
By the way, for Teal, you mentioned Dr. Strange. Is one of his comments by the Wild Winds of Watoom, by any chance?
Indeed, indeed.
One of the many.
Yep.
One of the many. Two very quick questions. Teal, are you still doing your trans-Appalachian historical time alternate timeline?
I don't know that I ever did that.
Oh, weren't you doing a series based on what happened after 1763?
No.
That's not me.
Oh, no.
Okay, then I apologize.
That's quite all right. I know who you're talking about, but that's not mine.
Okay. Who is he talking about?
Why can't I think of his name now? It went in my head. There's multiple people writing in it. It's the 1647 series.
Oh, that's Eric Flint.
No, that's a different series.
Okay.
But anyway,
no,
right.
Charles Gannon and Eric Flint do that series. Excuse me.
Yes. The other question.
And Barbara Krasnoff has written into that series.
Great. The other question I have for you.
So
you
I do know.
Who was the actor who played Hawk on Spencer for Hire again?
Avery Brooks.
Avery Brooks.
And what did he do on DS9?
He starred in it.
Yes, he was Sisko.
He was the captain.
Oh, he was Sisko.
He was Sisko, which is why I make the joke that he was Sisko for the first two seasons, then they let him shave his head and he became Hawk in space.
By the way, here's a last trivia question.
Very little time.
Who spoke the last word on episode 176 of DS9?
Me. The faintest.
Quark.
After I turned it off. Okay, thanks a lot. Have a good morning. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Yeah, Jim, what was the name of the off-Broadway play, The Alternate History of the Beatles?
Liverpool Fantasy.
Okay.
By Larry Cohen.
Did you know that Christopher Tolkien died just a few days ago?
Yeah, last week. Early last week. 95 years old.
Yeah, off to
Mount Doom.
Did you
ever have any contact with him?
No, only his father.
Oh, okay. All right, well, another famous Brit.
Yep.
We've lost too many.
Well, yep.
Good show this week. Look forward to tuning in next week. Thanks. Have a great
night. You too. Take care. Yeah, I'm worried about the death of Christopher Tolkien because he was sort of keeper of the flame.
He was working as being the steward of it all. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, one time that I was attending a computer trade show in Vegas, a consumer electronics show, or Comdex as it was called then, there was actually a Middle Earth slot machine. There really was, because about the time that the movies were hot,
uh-huh.
And it took And the people who owned the rights to the marketing were all too happy to sell it. But Christopher Tolkien sort of set, drew the line, said,
okay. My question would be, when you pulled the handle, did you have to get nine rings?
There was stuff like that, yes.
Oh, that's horrifying. It's truly horrifying.
No, because you could get three across and three down or diagonal.
Wow. That's
so
that's,
yes.
That is both clever and horrifying at the same moment.
Yeah, no, yeah. It was a video slot machine. It wasn't an actual physical machine.
Yeah,
but it was made by, I think, Williams and all that. And, yes, it took lawsuits to get it off the market.
Wow.
Good morning. You're on the radio.
Hey, my friends. Great show. Anytime you can go from Mike Mazursky. I love Murder, that, like you said, that one, Murder My Sweet. I also love Farewell My Lovely with Mitchum, who proved himself really in 47 out of the past. But
yes.
Still had it.
Yeah.
Nobody could wear a trench coat like Mitchum, really.
And he had those eyes. He had those half-lidded eyes that were just so perfect.
Don't leave out the cast. Young Stallone as well as John Ireland's in the movie.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, Stallone is one of the thugs in the cat house.
That's right.
But also, when you mentioned earlier, which got me, the Big Sleep, let's remember, the first one, I'm talking about the
40s. Yeah.
The good one.
A lot of the extra dialogue was thrown in because they had realized the chemistry they had with Bogart and Bacall.
Yep, they kept adding more scenes for them to make it sexier.
Yeah, but the cross dialogue, that was a Howard Hawks thing. And what he would do, if you take a look at the movie Little Women, directed by Greta Gerwig, she uses exactly that technique. And if you look at the screenplay, which I happen to have a copy of, because my partner is a member of the Writers Guild of America, there are lines they draw that this you can talk over here, but then this line has to be in the clear, and then somebody can talk over that line. And that's exactly how Howard Hawks did it.
That's how he designed the thing.
His Girl Friday is a prime example.
Oh, God, yes.
Yep.
But also, and I know you got others, but also, too, the great, one of the bad guys of Big Sleep, I'll never forget. He was so good in it, and though a generation probably know him better from F Troop, Bob Steele,
who was battling Bob Steele, who is a hero of mine, who went all the way from silent movies. He was Bradbury, was his real name. He was actually the son of a director in silence, all the way through the Three Musketeers and all the way up to F Troop. He's a real hero of mine, Bob Steele, battling Bob. I just saw him today in an episode of Wyatt Earp, playing a deputy.
I love Bob Steele.
And now you guys got me. I don't know him.
You know the face.
Chino.
Chino,
who Bogart guns down in the Big Sleep.
If
you remember.
Elijah Cooks Jr.'s character.
If you remember from the film version with, Lon Chaney Jr.,
Mice and Men.
Of Mice and Men, he's the one, he breaks his hand in the fight.
Oh!
That's Bob Steele. He was called Battling Bob because he always had great fist fights in his movies.
Okay.
Yes.
You know, there was a show on BAI that was incredibly popular that was called Whatever Became Of, done by a fellow named Richard Lamparski.
Mm-hmm.
And every week he would analyze a different character actor. And it was just wonderful. And he would do people like that. Like this week, Corinne Calvé, you know, who very few people knew and stuff like that. I knew Corinne.
Uh-huh. And you're no Corinne, sir.
I
thanks for mentioning again the great Sabu, I loved in films as a kid. I'm talking about I can't think of the Wizard film he did.
The Thief of Baghdad.
Baghdad
from
1940.
Thief of Baghdad with Conrad Veidt, 1940.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the original Elephant Boy film he did. And and Drum, also a quarter film.
Yeah, but Thief of Baghdad and The Jungle Book, I would have to say, are his two.
The pinnacle. Absolutely.
Yeah. And the idea that people talk about, quote, the original Jungle Book, and they don't know who Sabu is, it's like, no.
Well, there's a wonderful biography of him written by Philip Leibfried. If you guys can pick it up, it's a great little filmography and biography of Sabu.
Yeah, I'm going to have to look for that.
Yep.
I'm going to look for it as well.
Okay.
Take care, gentlemen. Great show.
You too.
Thank you. Take care. Have a wonderful night and morning. Okay. Well, we're out of time. We're not only out of time, we're over time. And I've already started the theme music. It's on one of these. There it is. It's on one of these potentiometers here. Teal James Glenn, where do people find out about you?
You can find out about me at theurbanswashbuckler.com, which is my website and blog. And I'm on Amazon. I've got books all over the place.
Okay. But if people go to your website,
if they go to the website,
they can find out which books and stuff.
Yes, although the website's a little behind. But it's certainly on Amazon. If you put Teal James Glenn, G-L-E-N-N, in.
T-E-E-L.
T-E-E-L. James Glenn, you'll find pages and pages of my stuff.
Absolutely. And so come see Teal in person and me along with Elizabeth Crowens on February 4th at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Admission is free, but we'll look at you cross-eyed in order to get a donation.
And we will have a phenomenal time.
You will. And yeah, come in steampunk. So thank you again for being here.
Thank you, James.
Our guest next week is Mimi Mandel. Her first time on in a couple of years.
So you're going from giant fun size to super awesome packed size.
I'll tell you a story about that off air. Okay, thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, I think. Stay tuned.
Oh, sure, it's not Golem?
Golem. More like Belch. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister, who is still, you know, well, he's getting ready there. So you can, there we go. This is what all the Facebook people, this is why Facebook exists, to see that. Okay, thank you all for listening. Everybody, be good to each other. Take good care. And we'll see you next week from 1, 2, 3. Good morning.
Good morning, one and all.
When I leave, you can remember I said with the last words on my lips that I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
bitch.
The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk my people, the people all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my writing is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they still have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue.
raise an infernal, cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fascists and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Like it's fighting. Won't get in no way, so no matter with him. No matter with you fussing and you're fighting.
The show is dedicated to you this morning. How are you feeling? 9 minutes after Burn Baby Burn time. Yes, we play all the music they refuse to play on Imperialist Radio in Imperialist USA. Burn Baby Burn. Clap us. Yeah. Yeah. This is the station that propagates the Midnight Ravers and After Selassie Labrish right on the weekend right here. You know, Mr. Terry Wilson at his very best, the Midnight Raver original. Killer Show. After Selassie. Killer Show. WBAI. Killer Station. 220 Sketch. Yeah. We have one hell of a rubber dog show for you today. Yeah. Impeaching a peach sandwich. Yeah, with no evidence. Just impeach a peach sandwich. You can impeach a peach sandwich. You can impeach a ham sandwich. But it's better to impeach a peach sandwich, right? All right, here we go. Here we go. Vinnett Price, your tune. Hear them tune now. Uh-huh. 10 minutes after the hour. 10 minutes after Burn Baby Burn Blackburn in time.
While I was moving.